punishment for sin is not by God. Let's look at, I mean, it's all over the place. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Don't be deceived, says Paul. God is not mocked. You reap what you sow. What we do has effects. We can't wish it away. And if the effects are there, we produce the effects by our behaviour for others and for ourselves. God is love. God is the one who heals, forgives, graces, asks us, calls us back, but doesn't force us back. And so from the beginning of this long statement about human behaviour, Paul, right at the beginning, sees it in relation to God. And as I said, that's the good part, because he's going to show how loving God is, what God has done in Jesus. So if we see it all in relation to God, we don't have to stop sinning. I'll finish the sentence in a minute. But stopping sinning is too hard. It's like you're in a room like here, and the sun's out there, and you've got all the blinds pulled down, and you're in the dark. How do you stop dark? You could wander around the bloomin' room all morning trying to stop the dark. Put a blanket over the top of it, that'll stop it. It doesn't work. You've got to actually open the blinds. But the beautiful part is that if you open the blinds, the dark goes. Do you get it? I mean, simple. So, in other words, by putting it focus on God first, right from the beginning, he's telling us, this is the way people are living. This is what's happening. This is the way the life around you and probably in you partly is all going on. So you fix it, not by doing anything about it, but by opening yourself to this wonderful grace. And the grace being welcomed, the darkness will go. Confucius, whom Jesus didn't know, said it's better to light a candle than to curse the dark. It's not bad advice when you start getting angry with your daughter-in-law or anybody else around the place. Cursing the dark. Where we live in a society that's got to find someone to blame. We're always blaming somebody. You may not be, and I hope I'm not, but we generally are looking for somebody to blame. And Confucius says, instead of putting all that energy into blaming your parents or somebody or the government or something, light a candle. Go on a demonstration. Don't blame the Prime Minister for the stupidity of what he's doing. Rather, go into a demonstration and show that you don't accept. You know what I mean? Do something. Light a candle. And the dark might go if enough of us do it. So, that's what this is about. Having said that, is that clear enough anyhow? It's a terribly important focus. He says something quite beautiful, which you all know, but it's lovely to hear it being said. For what can be known about God is plain to them, to everybody. It's plain. It stares you in the face. Because God has shown it to them, them means the world, people, by his creating of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he made. So sit in the garden and watch a flower and you'll see God. Look into the eyes of a little baby and you'll see God. Because God is the mystery, Taya de Chardin. God is the heart and the beyond of everything. So look at anything real and listen to beautiful music. You'll hear God. And listen to your own heart and you'll discover God. Isn't that how? So God isn't another thing out there to be searched for. God is actually the heart of everything. And if we go to the heart, your own heart, of course, and the heart of any situation, you will discover God, or rather God will discover you. So he's saying, look, it's really plain. If people were only real, if people only looked, listened, touched, loved, felt, and lived with all that, it'll be painful at times. But don't avoid it. Don't run away from the pain by drugs or something else escaping. Or don't get rid of your own anger by blasting some desert somewhere with people in it. Like, find out what the problem is and own it and face it and come to grips with it as a person and as a community and as a people, what a beautiful world it would be, don't you reckon? If we all were honest. It's all right to be sinful. I mean, it's not all right to be sinful. I mean, it's all right to be sinful. I mean, we're human beings. It's all right to be broken if you're broken. And if you own it, it can be healed. But if we hide from it, run from it, pretend it's not there and blame someone else, we get what we've got. So there's the Book of Wisdom. I won't read it to you. It's too beautiful. But read it later, chapter 13, verse 1 to 5, which says the same thing about creation, and you'll find it everywhere. So, this is Paul's conclusion to verse 20. Because it's all obvious, they are without excuse. Who are without excuse? Your short-term memories are better than mine. Those who, by their wickedness, suppress the truth. That's what he's talking about. The whole thing is about that. And if you find you're suppressing the truth, it applies to you. And if I do, it applies to me. And maybe we are in ways we don't realize. But it is all about suppression of truth, not about human behavior that we may not know any other way to behave. So, because he says God is obvious. Now, that's verse 20. Verse 21, I'll just read here. He begins. They are without excuse. For though they knew God, though they were in communion with God, though God is relating to us all, through love particularly, but through our whole beautiful creation, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him. But I've translated this as very important to keep watching all the time through here for the passive. Passive. It's not what we're doing, it's what's happening to us. It's what we're suffering. It's what's, and in a sense, God is here, mysteriously part of the providence of all this. They were reduced to futility in their thinking. That's what the Greek is, it's passive. He's not saying they were foolish in the way they thought. But he's saying the way they're acting has brought them to be foolish. Get it? It's the effect. It's what they're suffering, what we're suffering. I'm saying they, but I don't want to exclude anybody. It's what happens to us when we behave. Their hearts lacking insight, again passive, their hearts were darkened. And you look at your own life. I'll look at mine and we've all got little memories, I'm sure, that I have some, and you must have some too. You know, because we're all born very sensitive. Absolutely all of us. We're just gorgeous when we're a day old. You know, really so sweet and gorgeous and open and ready for everything. So, and terribly sensitive. We could smell our mother's breast from 100 yards away, probably. No, I don't know how long, how tall, but do you know what I mean? We're sensitive, we're open to the mystery, and our eyes are just waiting to. So that's how we all are. But if I'm allowed to get away as a 14-year-old child with being selfish, you know, self-grasping by my mum and dad, who give me, whatever, because if I'm allowed to get away with that, can't you see that when I'm 15 months old, I'm a bit more selfish, 16 months old, 17 months old, and I'm a tyrant when I'm 2, and by the time I marry you, you think, what have I married? Because we desensitize. Or alternatively, if your beautiful parents helped you, no one's going to do it completely successfully. Look at us, we're just about all half done, but we're getting there. If your parent taught you to be thoughtful, respectful with your body, you know, and with people, and prepared you for the birth of the second kid, or I don't know what. But if they did that to you, gradually you learn, don't you, to think of others, to buy little gifts for other people. Some children are so, they come in and they want to give you something. Like, it's beautiful, isn't it? And the one who's been beautiful is mum and dad, or grandma and grandpa, or uncle, or somebody. So Okay. And as I say this, you're probably all feeling that you failed as a parent, and I'm feeling as a priest I've made a mess of it. But anyhow, no, we're all partly all this. But somehow or other, if we lack insight, we become darker. If you suppress the truth in one area, eventually we don't even see it. Claiming to be wise, they were made foolish. It's passive. They didn't just become foolish. Their behaviour brought about stupidity, foolishness. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling a mortal human being or birds or four-footed animals or reptiles. He was thinking, probably unfairly, but of all the pagan religions, you know, they've got this wonderful sense of God, that we're all called by God, and God becomes a snake or a thing or a fast car when you're 21 as a bloke, or a Sheila. You know, what is God? I mean, it depends on where we are, but God is what you worship. Power, position, I don't know what. We create all these stupid things for ourselves. Now we begin our journey of describing the world, Paul's world. And if the cap fits, he says, wear it. Therefore, God gave them up. God gave them up. Now that's because God can't do anything else. God isn't controlling our lives. He's loving our lives. God gave them up to the lusts of their heart, to impurity, to the degrading of their bodies among themselves. Before I go on, it's absolutely typical of Paul, whenever he lists sins, behaviour that's dysfunctional, I think always, but if not always, it's generally, he begins with sexual sins. Not because Paul has a sexual hang-up, but because it's a good place to start. Because sexuality is about the way we love, the way we relate. It's critically central. And so he's not beginning because he thinks sex is exciting. I suppose he did. And we're all supposed to think that, and I guess it is. I mean, that's what it's about. But he begins there because it's about love. And if we behave sexually in a bad way, we're actually corrupting our heart and we're using people, aren't we? Rather than loving them, we're actually escaping with them or treating them in a way that's degrading or just getting pleasure from them without reaching right into their heart or without the commitment that goes with sexuality of joy and wonder and gratitude and all those things that you know human relationships to be. And everything we do is sexual, of course. Sexuality we often relate to husband, wife, man, woman, but being a father of a child or a mother of a child. I mean, everything about us is sexual, isn't it? Everything about us is being human, man or woman. So, but here he's starting with this degrading world that he looked at, and good God, is ours any better? Let's just read what he says about it. God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the degrading of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And they worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. And then he goes into this. He starts with homosexual sexual behavior. I'll have to say something a little bit more about it, but that's where he starts. And this is typical of a Jew looking at the Gentile world of his day, just as for us it might be. So the Jewish world was very protective of this. And when they looked at the Greeks and the way they behaved and the Romans and the way they behaved sexually, because they were, the Greek culture was bisexual. It was pubescent. It was kind of pre-commitment. So it seems. And I could tell you a lot more about it, but from what I know. But for example, men were encouraged to have a young man to train in sexual things. So pederasty, which we send people to court for, was mostly considered quite a good thing, to have a boy learning. Provided, it had a lot of provisos in it, that they weren't just rabidly sexually rampant or anything, provided there was an intellectual aspect to it, and provided you cared for the boy, and provided there was real affection there, and you trained him in the art of living and discovery, and took him to the baths and told him about literature and sport and warfare. You know, I mean, it wasn't just dirty kind of stuff. But the homosexual relationship was there and was very common and quite encouraged in their world. In fact, in the Greek world, you read all the literature, it's all there. It's all male, because the men wrote the literature, you see. Woman's place was very obvious. You had to have kids, you wanted kids, so you had the wife to get kids. But the real love in your life, the best love for a man, is another male. I mean, that's real love, because it's free of a whole lot of things and commitments and kids and all that. This must sound strange. It sounds strange to me when I read it, but I've read a lot about it, and that's the way it was. And in fact, as you well know, I bet, I won't ask you to say anything, but I bet a lot of women in this particular group here, your dearest love could well be for another woman, because you can talk with her about anything. Do you know what I mean? There's a beautiful friendship, of course, possible between woman and woman and man and man. But in their world, it tended to be sexual as well. The whole person loved, and so there was no homophobia in the Greek world. There was terrible misogyny, looking down on women and considering them second-rate citizens and all that stuff. There's massive literature on that. It's rare. In fact, it's so rare, I think, in this ancient world, there are only about two or three, I should know, but I've just forgotten, ever mentioning of female homosexual love. And this is one of them. It's terrifically rare to have it as part of literature, probably because the men didn't bother about it, thinking about it. So, but that's their world they're living in. I could take you through the Old Testament material on this, but I haven't got time now, and I don't know that you want to journey with me. Those of you who did 1 Corinthians with me, I went at great length looking at 1 Corinthians 6:9, which is the only other time Paul has mentioned homosexual activity. Before I read it, it's very important to know that Paul never talks about homosexuality. He wasn't aware of it. In other words, the condition whereby a person may be sexually drawn to a member of their own sex, a woman to a woman or a man to a man. The psychological level doesn't occur in any of his writings. In fact, it doesn't occur nearly anywhere. We're a much more psychologically aware community. We've learnt a lot about psychology, thank God. And it's changed a lot of our notions about moral behaviour too, by the way. What Paul is concerned about here is overt behaviour. Do you get it? That's what he's actually talking about. And he's talking about what you see, what's external. Is a good thing to say, whenever Paul lists sins, especially if he lists them without any opening up, often they're just what he was taught as a boy. Don't take it as God's last word on the subject, especially here. He's listing things that every Jew was taught. Look at the Greeks, look at the way they have men and boys together. It's unnatural, it's against the will of God. Do you get it? But they knew nothing about the psychology, they knew nothing about homosexuality, they knew nothing about any of that. And there's no evidence at all that they were talking about committed love, because they never thought of committed love. I mean, husband, wife, family, the obvious things. The world that this all comes out of was a heterosexual world. It still is. The majority of people. So everybody thought the way the majority thinks. Unless you happen to be one of the minority that had to struggle with all this homosexual inclinations, which nobody understood, and everybody among the Jews thought was bad and all that. I haven't said all that well, it's too complex a question. But I just say you must be very careful when you're reading Paul's lists not to make that a basis for arguments today, when we know so much more about the human psyche. We have to be far... I mean, of course you may disagree with me on this, and I haven't put it clearly enough to either agree or disagree, but I do know that we have to keep human behaviour is something we have to keep understanding more and more and more, and we have to be very careful about strict, absolute judgments, especially if we're just drawing on this is the most complete statement Paul makes on it, and that's clearly how he saw it, Would he have seen it that way if he knew what you know and I know about homosexuality? I don't know the answer to that question. You don't either. Nobody does. Paul is, you've got to go right back to always in Paul to what is his vision? What's he saying? What's the judgment he's making? And then, of course, he says, like all of us, he quotes what he knows, or thinks he knows, in the light of his real circumstances of that day. What he's talking about here is exactly what he's just said, living a lie, forgetting God, and getting caught up in all this, what he sees, street behaviour, coiffured young men wandering around, which he saw, we know it existed, selling themselves. Greek Stoics didn't want that either. They were totally against brothels. They were totally against sex slavery. It existed. The Greek moralists were against young men flaunting themselves for money. Do you get it? They weren't just immoral. They were against all that. They also, however, saw as quite good, and on the balance a good thing, to have older males initiating younger males into the male world, which was a dominant, putting women down world, sadly to say, and very aware. They didn't see that as immoral, many of them. And so that's the, and when Paul as a Jew looked at it, he saw it as horrible, terrible. And he was basically right. But to quote Paul today, I would say, be very careful. Okay, they exchanged the truth. For this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural. And in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. And since they didn't see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. God didn't change them, he forced them to a debased mind and to things that should not be done. And the Greek there is kathekonta, a technical Stoic word. He was trained in Stoicism, Paul, and he saw this behaviour here as immoral, and he's quoting the textbooks, if you like, about it. Then he goes on to a long list. I won't be long now, I promise you. I'll just pretty well read it, because they were filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, craftiness, gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventive in ways of doing evil, rebellious towards parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Pretty grim picture, but couldn't you still say a lot of that? I mean, that's the world he was looking at, that's how he sees it. And he concludes, they know God's decrees that those who practice such things deserve to die, yet they not only do them, but they applaud others who do them. That's the conclusion of chapter 1. I just want to leave you with the key point. Within the limits of Paul's own education, and of course they're limited, as I've tried to point out, psychologically and in other ways, he's describing the world in very black and white terms. He's not saying everybody's living like this, of course. His own mother probably was a saint. So he's not saying everybody's living like this, but he's saying this is the kind of world we're in, aren't we? And the Romans would have to either look inside or look outside, and they'd see it and they'd say, yeah, that's the kind of world we're in. He's going to make the point that the Jewish world is no better than the Gentile world in this. So we're all needing something, and it isn't just automatic coming through the family. His whole point is God looking at this world will need God to do something. We'll need God to grace us. We'll need forgiveness. will need love, will need a big breakthrough. Whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Gentile, you'll need some enormous act of love on God to help us as a wide, big world live beautifully. So, he's going to go on to describe what that beautiful gift is that will lift us all out of the mess. And of course, it means for us today just as much.